Imagine, just for a second, stepping into a time machine.
Okay, I'm with you.
You open the door,
right? Yeah.
And you're standing in the middle of this English colony in the late 1500s, but it's completely abandoned. Like, everyone has just vanished into thin air.
Creepy.
Exactly. Then you jump forward, and now you're staring at a massive ancient Mexican pyramid, but it's completely swallowed by a literal jungle.
Oh, wow.
And then you jump one more time, and you're suddenly looking at this multi-billion-dollar city being planned for the lunar South Pole.
That is quite the itinerary.
Right. It feels like utter chaos.
Yeah.
Just a random assortment of completely unrelated flashcards.
It absolutely does. I mean, when you're dealing with trivia, the brain instinctively wants to categorize things, you know? Ugh. Put the history in one box, the astronomy in another, and just keep it all neatly separated.
But that is exactly what we are going to tear down today. Welcome to our deep dive into the sources. We've taken this sprawling, seemingly chaotic stack of topics from a recent Mind Games trivia challenge, and, well, our mission is to find the hidden narrative threads that connect them all for you.
Because we aren't just reciting facts here.
Definitely not. We're exploring a grand synthesis of human knowledge. Okay, let's unpack this, starting with the idea that the entire universe, from the microscopic stuff to the geographic, operates on these incredibly strict rules of physical pressure and alignment.
Which is really the perfect place to start, because when you look at the fundamental building blocks of life, pressure and precision are just, they are everything. Let's look at the DNA double helix, for example.
Yeah, people tend to picture it as just this passive twisting ladder, right?
Exactly, like a spiral staircase. But it is actually a structural marvel bound by incredibly strict rules of mechanical tension. In that double helix, each base pairs with only one specific counterpart.
Right. It's like an exclusive biological handshake.
Right.
You have cytosine forming exactly three hydrogen bonds, exclusively with guanine on the opposite strand.
Yep.
And then you have adenine pairing with thymine.
And those three hydrogen bonds between cytosine and guanine, they are crucial. They aren't just, you know, chemical suggestions. They create the exact mechanical tension required to maintain the uniform structure of the helix.
So without that exact fit,
without that precise physical pressure, the entire genetic architecture would collapse. I mean, accurate replication of your genetic information would be completely impossible. The system aggressively rejects anything that doesn't fit the lock.
Like leucine.
Yes, exactly. For instance, the trivia stack brings up leucine. Leucine is an amino acid, not a DNA base. If you try to force it into that helix, it fundamentally fails the alignment test.
It just doesn't fit.
Right. It plays absolutely no role because it cannot sustain that microscopic pressure.
So we have this flawless microscopic pressure system keeping us alive.
Right.
But what happens when a physical pressure system breaks down on a larger scale, like inside the human body?
It gets ugly, yeah.
Think about a kinked garden hose in your backyard. The water is still pumping from the spigot, but it has nowhere to go. So the pressure violently builds up behind the kink.
Yeah.
That same hydraulic nightmare happens in the human liver.
You're talking about cirrhosis.
Right.
When liver tissue develops severe scarring, that scar tissue acts exactly like the kink in your garden hose. It physically obstructs the normal flow of blood through the organ.
And that leads to a mechanical failure called portal hypertension, doesn't it?
Yes.
The blood is trying to move forward, but the liver acts as a dam. So the blood has to find a detour, and it forcefully backs up into the veins of the lower esophagus.
And what's fascinating here is the brutal physics of that backup. Those esophageal veins are absolutely not designed for that kind of high-pressure traffic.
No, not at all.
They balloon outward, forming what we call varices. These esophageal varices are essentially hyperpressurized pockets of trapped blood, and if the pressure isn't relieved, those veins can rupture.
Which is incredibly dangerous.
It leads to catastrophic, life-threatening bleeding. The body also tries to relieve this internal pressure in other ways, like leaking fluid into the abdomen, which is a condition known as ascites.
Which, for a listener, is pronounced ascites. It's a terrifying example of fluid dynamics. But let's take that concept of massive fluid backups and scale it up to the planet itself.
Let's do it.
When environmental systems face immense pressure, how does life adapt? That brings us to Lake Eyre, or officially, Katithonda, down in Australia.
Katithonda is a masterclass in extreme environmental pressure. It is Australia's lowest natural point, sitting roughly 15 meters below sea level. But geographically, it is what's known as an endorheic basin.
And for anyone who doesn't spend their weekends reading geography textbooks, an endorheic basin is essentially a geological dead end, right?
Exactly. It's a closed drainage basin. So water from surrounding rivers flows into it, but it cannot flow out to the ocean.
It just pools there.
Right. You have this massive sinkhole situated directly south of the Simpson Desert. So you have these red, arid desert sands meeting this vast lake bed.
But here is the catch. Because the atmospheric pressure and extreme evaporation in that desert environment are so intense, the lake is almost always a completely dry, blindingly white salt flat.
It rarely ever fills with floodwaters.
Yeah, it is an incredibly hostile environment that forces life to drastically alter its mechanics to survive, which perfectly sets up another subject from our trivia stack, the Natterjack Toad.
Ah, the Natterjack.
Now, hold on. Let me stop you right there, because this is where the trivia starts feeling a bit contradictory. The Natterjack Toad is native to the sandy dunes and heathlands of Europe. But, you know, we know amphibians are highly water-dependent.
Very true.
So how does a water-dependent amphibian survive in an environment defined by extreme evaporation and loose, dry sand?
Well, it survives through hyper-specific mechanical adaptations. Think about the physics of a frog hopping.
Okay.
If you try to jump off a pile of loose, dry sand, you lose almost all your kinetic energy.
Oh, because the sand just gives way underneath you.
Exactly. It's wildly inefficient.
Hmm.
So the Natterjack Toad evolved to have much shorter legs than a typical toad, which gives it a distinctive running gait.
Wait, it runs?
It literally runs across the sand instead of hopping.
That is brilliant. It changes its entire mode of locomotion just to handle the terrain.
Right, and to deal with the evaporative pressure and the fact that water disappears quickly, it doesn't rely on deep, permanent ponds.
Makes sense.
It breeds in warm, shallow, temporary pools that form right after a rain. But because those pools might evaporate in a matter of days, the toad has to work fast.
No time to waste.
None. The males have actually developed an incredibly loud rasping call to ensure they can attract a mate immediately before the water vanishes. The environment applies pressure, and the biology answers. Though, sadly, because of human expansion and habitat loss, they are now a rare and protected species.
Which is a perfect pivot, I think. Because while the toad adapts its body to the harsh landscape, humans kind of do the exact opposite.
We certainly do.
We try to force the landscape to adapt to us. We look at a brutal, untamed environment, and we try to impose perfect geometric order on it. Think about the Western United States. Look at Utah.
Okay.
It's a completely landlocked state, bordering five others.
Yeah.
But look specifically at its southern border with Arizona.
The Four Corners region.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You have this incredibly rugged, unforgiving desert canyon landscape, and human map makers just, you know, drew perfect intersecting right angles across it.
It really is the sheer hubris of human cartography. We try to map and settle the unknown by drawing literal lines in the sand.
But the environment doesn't always tolerate our maps, does it?
No, it doesn't. Sometimes human systems completely fail against environmental pressure.
Case in point, the Roanoke colony. In 1587, Governor John White, who was actually an English artist and cartographer, led an expedition of over 100 settlers to establish a colony in the New World.
And they hit severe, immediate challenges.
Huge challenges. White had to sail back to England for supplies later that same summer. But because of the Spanish Armada and naval blockades, he didn't make it back until 1590.
And we all know what he found, or rather, what he didn't find.
The entire settlement was abandoned. Over 100 people vanished without a trace. The only clue left behind was the word Croatoan carved into a wooden post.
Just erased?
Yeah, an entire mapped, planned settlement was simply erased by the pressures of an isolated frontier.
It was an isolated gamble that failed completely.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Let me push back on you, or rather, let me push back on the timeline of human ambition here.
All right, go for it.
If we couldn't even maintain a colony on Earth in 1587 without losing absolutely everyone because of a supply chain issue, how is NASA's current 2026 Lunar South Pole mission viable?
That's a fair question.
I mean, it's a $20 billion seven-year plan to build a sustained human presence on the moon. And the moon is infinitely more hostile than Roanoke Island. Furthermore, part of NASA's plan is literally redirecting components that were originally meant for an orbiting space station down to the lunar surface to support the infrastructure.
It sounds risky when you put it like that.
Doesn't it just sound like a $20 billion disaster waiting to happen?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the viability of NASA's plan lies in learning from the exact failure of Roanoke.
How so?
Roanoke died because of total isolation. It relied on one single ship returning. NASA's seven-year plan for the Lunar South Pole succeeds specifically by avoiding isolation. They aren't going it alone.
They have partners.
Yes. They are establishing this base through dozens of overlapping missions in partnership with commercial entities and international space agencies. And by repurposing those orbiting station parts for surface infrastructure, they are proving they can adapt existing technology on the fly.
So they're building a continuous redundant support network.
Exactly. It's less about planting a single flag and more about building a collaborative mountain of resources over time.
Which actually brings to mind another colossal human achievement from our trivia stack that succeeded through overlapping generational effort.
The Great Pyramid of Cholula in Mexico.
Yes, the man-made mountain.
It really is. It is the largest pyramid ever built by volume in human history. We're talking over 4.45 million cubic meters. That is nearly twice the volume of the Great Pyramid of Giza.
That's massive.
And unlike Roanoke, which vanished in 3 years, Cholula was built successfully over many centuries, starting around the 3rd century BCE. Successive cultures just kept adding to it, layer upon layer.
But there's a deep irony here, I think. Yeah, Roanoke completely disappeared into thin air, leaving nothing but a word. Cholula is this colossal, literal mountain of stone, and yet it is mostly hidden in plain sight. Nature and subsequent conquerors completely took it over.
It's covered by dense vegetation.
Yeah, and there's a massive Catholic church built right on top of it by the Spanish. It is vastly larger in bulk than anything else, yet visually, you'd hardly know it was a pyramid.
It really shows that physical monuments are incredibly vulnerable to the passage of time. They get overgrown, they get repurposed, or just lost. But cultural monuments, the ones built out of ideas, often survive much longer.
Which transitions us beautifully from the physical monuments of stone and space into the monuments of words and music.
A different kind of architecture.
Exactly. And what we find in the trivia stack is that the cultural expressions that endure the longest are often the ones that strip away the complex noise and focus on a singular, raw truth.
Well, let's talk about the Latin word cygnus, which means swan. Cygnus is a prominent northern constellation in the Milky Way, often called the Northern Cross, and it contains the incredibly bright star Deneb. But in ancient mythology, the name connects directly to stories of transformation, like the figure Cycnus, who was transformed into a swan.
So it's an ancient symbol of shedding an outer shell to reveal a new form beneath.
Precisely.
And we see that technique of stripping away facades in classic storytelling all the time to reveal inherent flaws. Think of Aesop's famous fable, The Fox and the Crow.
A classic.
Right. The hungry fox sees a crow sitting in a tree holding a delicious piece of cheese in her beak. Now, the fox doesn't try to climb the tree or fight the crow. Instead, he uses flattery to strip away her practical sense.
He praises her physical beauty and then suggests that a bird so gorgeous must have a singing voice to match. He asks her to sing just one song so he can officially declare her the queen of birds.
And of course, the crow's ego balloons. She opens her beak to sing, the cheese drops straight into the fox's mouth, and the fox delivers a brutal moral of the story: do not trust flatterers.
He completely stripped away her practical intelligence by inflating her ego, exposing her vulnerability.
Exactly.
And that exposure of inherent flaws, you know, stripping away a pious exterior to reveal the darkness underneath, that is the exact literary territory of the great American novelist Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Oh, absolutely. Hawthorne was a definitive master of dark romanticism. He was totally obsessed with exploring the nature of sin, guilt, and the inherent evil of humanity.
He drew very heavily from his own New England ancestry, didn't he?
He did. He used it to critique the rigid, unforgiving morality of colonial Puritan society. In classic works like The Scarlet Letter and the short story Young Goodman Brown, you have characters who are completely agonizing over secret sins while facing the harsh societal condemnation of their peers.
Because the Puritans desperately wanted to present a flawless, highly pious surface to the world. A perfect, godly society.
Right. And Hawthorne dedicated his entire literary career to showing the rotting wood beneath that paint job. He forced the reader to confront the hypocrisy of that facade.
He stripped it all away.
And this leads to my absolute favorite cultural analogy in this entire deep dive. Think about Hawthorne aggressively stripping away the perfect, colorful facade of the Puritans to reveal the raw truth underneath. Now, flash forward to 1968, and look what the Beatles did.
Ah, the White Album.
Yes. The Beatles release their self-titled double album, which is universally known as the White Album. Up until this point, they were famous for these incredibly dense, colorful, wildly psychedelic album covers.
Like Sweat Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Exactly. That was pure visual sensory overload. but for the white album, they gave a completely plain, blank white cover.
No band photos on the front whatsoever.
None. Just the band's name discreetly embossed in the lower right corner and a unique serial number.
Which is fascinating. And this raises an important question. Why do these intentional contrasts resonate so deeply with us?
What do you mean?
Why is the stark blankness of the White Album, or Hawthorne's exposure of Puritan hypocrisy, or even the deceptive flattery of Aesop's Fox so memorable? It's because they force the audience to confront the core message without any distractions.
Oh, I see.
The loudest statement the Beatles could make at the height of psychedelic rock was total silence on their album cover. It's an intimacy achieved by stripping things down to the studs.
That makes perfect sense. And we see that same stripped-down intimacy driving massive hits in modern music, too. Like in 1996, the Dave Matthews Band released Crash Into Me as a single from their multi-platinum album Crash.
A huge song.
Massive. But in an era of heavy grunge and synthesized pop, this song was defined by a very distinctive raw acoustic guitar riff, incredibly intimate, almost voyeuristic lyrics. It heavily defined their 90s jam band sound, got massive radio play, and decades later, it remains an absolute staple of their live shows.
It's simple, it's raw, and it sticks.
Yeah.
It's an alchemy, really. Taking simple, basic components, an acoustic riff, an intimate lyric, and transforming them into a cultural monument.
Okay. Linking Dave Matthews Band and the White Album to the literal yeast sludge of beer brewing is going to require some serious mental gymnastics, but hear me out.
I'm intrigued.
Because that brings us to the final phase of our deep dive, the art of repurposing and the magic of rare alignments. Let's talk about Marmite.
The ultimate polarizing breakfast bread. You either love it or you despise it.
Exactly. Invented in Burton-upon-Trent in the UK back in 1902, Marmite is this dark, thick, savory spread that is fortified with B vitamins, and it has a famously intense umami taste.
But how is it actually made?
Well, it is made primarily from yeast extract.
Which is literally the concentrated leftover byproduct of brewing beer.
Yes. They took the discarded waste sludge from the brewing process garbage, essentially, and used human ingenuity to transform it into a beloved, vitamin-rich national icon.
They forced an alignment between brewing waste and nutritional science.
And that alchemy of taking discarded scraps and turning them into icons extends to pop culture, too. Think about the 1960s Batman television series. The iconic Batmobile from that show is an absolute legend. But the custom car builder, George Barris, didn't build it from scratch. He modeled it after and physically built it from a highly unique 1955 Lincoln Futura concept car.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Ford had originally developed this futuristic car for the auto show circuit, but it was just a discarded concept shell by the 60s. Barris acquired this forgotten vehicle from Ford for exactly one single dollar.
$1.
$1.
And he transformed a $1 piece of scrap into the ultimate crime-fighting vehicle in just 3 weeks.
So what does this all mean? We look at a $1 auto show cast off becoming the Batmobile. We look at literal beer waste becoming Marmite.
It means that greatness, or, you know, cultural significance, doesn't require pristine, perfect materials from the start.
Right.
It is all about alignment and repurposing. Sometimes we force that alignment through sheer human will, like George Barris with a welding porch in his garage, or British brewers isolating yeast sludge. But sometimes history just hands you a perfect, unplannable alignment that you simply get to witness.
Like Major League Baseball's opening day in the year 2000.
Yes, a statistical anomaly that you couldn't engineer if you tried. Across April 3rd and 4th of 2000, for the first time in MLB history, 3 grand slams were hit on opening day.
And they weren't even in the same game. It was 3 completely separate games. Richard Hidalgo hit one for the Houston Astros, Fred McGriff hit one for the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, and Eric Karras hit one for the Los Angeles Dodgers.
Think about the variables required for that. 3 separate players in 3 separate cities against 3 separate pitchers, all independently loading the bases and then executing the rarest and most impactful offensive play in the sport, simultaneously creating a perfect alignment in the history books.
It's wild.
You can't force that. You can't build a $20 billion NASA roadmap to make that happen. The universe just aligns.
It really is incredible when you step back and look at the sheer scope of the narrative threads we've pulled today. I mean, we started at the microscopic level looking at the exact physical tension of hydrogen bonds holding our DNA together with cytosine and guanine. And then we zoomed out to the brutal, dry salt flats of Lake Eyre and watched the natterjack toad physically change its gait to run across the sand. We look upward to a 2026 lunar base learning from the vanished, mapped-out failure of the Roanoke colony.
The threads just keep connecting.
They really do. We navigated the cultural expressions of Hawthorne exposing the Puritans and the Beatles realizing that a blank white cover is louder than a psychedelic one. And we ended with the pure magic of repurposing a $1 Lincoln Futura and witnessing three unplannable grand slams.
And you know, that is the true value of synthesizing your knowledge. Being well-informed isn't just about memorizing isolated trivia facts to win a pub quiz.
No, not at all.
It's about seeing the vast, interconnected web. It's about understanding how humanity builds, adapts, creates, and survives the immense physical and cultural pressures of the universe.
That's beautifully said. Earlier, we discussed how the Great Pyramid of Cholula, this colossal mountain of human architecture, was eventually swallowed by vegetation and hidden beneath the church. And we talked about how the Roanoke colony completely vanished without a trace, leaving only a cryptic carving on a post.
Yeah.
It forces you to wonder, and I want you to really think about this as you look around your own city today, what massive physical or cultural monument of our current modern era might be completely overgrown, forgotten, or wildly misunderstood by historians a few thousand years from now.
That's a great question.
Will they know what we were trying to build, or will they just see the chaotic landscape we left behind?